I don't know how that fits with the confidentiality thing, like if we're all wearing branded t-shirts. Pull this off again. Right. Okay, let's go. So, hope you all had a good small group time. We're going to look in this session at light in the darkness. So we've seen that holiness means living differently to the culture around us. Thank you. And we've looked at God's pattern for our sexuality. So in this session, we're going to unpack a little bit more about how biblical sexuality is a light in the darkness of our culture and some of the cultural narratives and how we can stand firm against some of the stuff that's really difficult. So there's three things that I'm going to talk about. Being a light in the darkness is countercultural. Being a light in the darkness is hard. And being a light in the darkness is worth it. So firstly, being a light in the darkness is and always has been countercultural. We as Christians should stand out from the people around us. So how do people know that we're Christians? What outward signs are there? Well, you know, you might wear a cross necklace. I wear a cross necklace. You might have a Bible verse tattoo. Tick. You might have a fish badge on your car. I don't have that one because of my driving. I kind of think, like, if you cut somebody up, they're just going to think flipping Christians. But nobody thinks, well, that person's driving really well. I must check out Christianity. So, anyway, no offence if you do have a fish badge. It's good. It's fine. There's nothing wrong with these things, is there? But there ought to be bigger signs that Jesus' way is different in every area of our lives. How we steward our sexuality puts the gospel on display because it's so countercultural. Western culture has moved significantly away from traditional biblical ethics on homosexuality over recent decades. So homosexuality has gone from moral bad to moral good in a few generations. And my PowerPoint seems to have disappeared. The computer's died.
Back on. We didn't have it plugged in.
Round of applause for the tech team, everybody. No, they do a great job. It's okay, we'll do this bit without. So, I was just going to give you a little potted summary of legislation over the last a few decades. There we go. Thank you very much. So in 1967, the Sexual Offences Act legalised homosexuality between consenting adults aged 21 plus. Fast forward to 2003 and the controversial Section 28 legislation was repealed. If you remember, that came in the Thatcher era and it prohibited the promotion of homosexuality by local authorities. That was finally repealed in 2003. And just a year later, the Civil Partnership Act came in. 2013, the Marriage Same-Sex Couples Act came in. And in 2020, last year, the government mandated that relationships education should be compulsory for all primary pupils. It should include LGBT content, and there's no right for parents to withdraw their children. So that's quite a sweep, isn't it, in a couple of generations. In 1967, homosexuality was illegal, and since last year, it's illegal not to promote it as equally valid alongside heterosexual marriage. Now, obviously, some of those changes are good. It's good that gay people aren't persecuted under the law anymore. But the new liberal orthodoxy makes it harder to speak out and to live out a biblical sexual ethic. There's a guy called Glyn Harrison who's written a book called A Better Story, which is really good. I recommend reading it. And he says this. In less than a generation, however, the Christian moral vision that human beings flourish when sexual interests are bounded in lifelong covenant between a man and a woman has seen a profound loss of cultural power. The modern Western morality of sex is broadly founded on consent between adults. And some people add in kind of mutual love or commitment to that criteria, but that's generally the criteria for an appropriate relationship. So within that framework, we can see why non-Christians and increasing numbers of Christians can't see anything wrong with gay relationships. You may well have asked yourself or been asked, what's the harm in a loving, monogamous, same-sex relationship? Shouldn't everyone have the freedom to express their sexuality? Isn't repression dangerous? And isn't it hypocritical to say that sex is good and then deny its goodness for same-sex couples? I think one of the issues is that sex is seen as a primary goal of life in our culture. Whether we like it or not, we're surrounded by this narrative and it feeds into our own thoughts and desires. Brands are adapting, sometimes controversially, and portraying different types of family setups and role models. So we see, you know, gay couples, step-parents, challenging gender stereotypes, but it's still focused around sex and romance. Films and literature and music, Disney, royal weddings, they all tell this fairy tale story of romantic bliss. And the implication is that unless you're having sex, you're condemned to a life of loneliness and isolation. We live in a society that sort of conflates sex and intimacy and makes romantic relationships the ultimate good. So I've tried to express that in an equation for some reason. I don't know why, not really into maths, but... So it sort of goes like this. The logic is, you know, intimacy and sex are conflated. So everybody needs intimacy. If you're not having sex, then you're deprived of intimacy. And therefore, everybody needs to be able to have sex. But this argument isn't right, is it? There are lots of forms of intimacy that don't involve having sex. And how is this valuing people who aren't having sex? There's a strong cultural message that you're not fulfilled if you're not having sex and that there might even be something wrong with you. This was I think it was the Guardian problem pages or something. I'm 34 and still a virgin, what's wrong with me? I take some medication and I went to the chemist to sort of get my prescription. And this medication, it's dangerous to get pregnant on it. And the chemist was very insistent in telling me that. And he was going on and on about, you know, what contraception are you using and all this sort of stuff. And I just got really fed up and I just said, I'm not having sex with a full chemist. And he was so embarrassed, he scuttled off into the store cupboard. Never saw him again. But it's weird, isn't it? It's just very different. I learned an interesting fact the other day, actually. So that's a ferret. female ferret. And I learned that female ferrets die if they don't have sex. So I know. Oh, I'm really glad I'm not a ferret. For so many reasons. So there we go. Anyway. So let's have a look again at that sex equation and see if we can unpick it a little bit. The conclusion seems to be blatantly untrue. So it seems to me that all but the second proposition are false. So intimacy and sex are not the same thing. Sex is certainly one way of experiencing intimacy, but it's not the only way. Regardless of our biological family makeup, knowing Jesus brings us into a new family, which means that we have parents and we have children and siblings and aunties and mad uncles. And this seems like a brilliantly positive thing that we can say to the world. You don't need to be in a sexual or a romantic relationship to have value and meaning, because the creator of the universe loves you intimately and wants you to know him. And he wants to draw you into this loving community of his people. But sadly, we haven't always got this message right in the church. Many times the church has just offered a Christianized version of the cultural story. So often in our kind of secular culture, losing your virginity is seen as a rite of passage into adulthood. But in much of church culture, that can be replaced with marriage. There's a real danger that we can idolize marriage and elevate it above singleness, which is bad news for married and single people. Because it can push people into marriages that aren't wise, or it can create an unrealistic burden on a marriage. And it also says to single people, you're missing out on something that's vital. You're somehow incomplete. My bit of a bugbear of mine is people referring to their spouses as their other half. I'm like, what, you know, am I half a person then? We've got into this mess over gay marriage because we've bought into the cultural narrative that you're unfulfilled without sex. We're making sex an ultimate thing, an idol. We need to acknowledge where we've gone wrong when it comes to sex, singleness, marriage and purity in the church. I was trawling the internet and I found some of this kind of damaging narratives that the church has been guilty of in the past. So some of you will be familiar with the kind of American purity culture type thing where you take a pledge to not have sex until you're married, which obviously is a biblical thing, but the way it's couched, true love waits, blah, 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 I'll be abstinent until I enter a biblical marriage. There's a big assumption there, isn't there? And it's kind of makes it feel like singleness is a holding pattern before the real life of nuclear family starts. So the purpose of being pure is that when you get married, you'll have great sex. And also, it equates love with sex. True love waits. Does that mean, you know, single people don't have any love? This one's really annoying as well. Being single doesn't mean no one wants you. It means God is still busy writing your love story. Yuck. It's like a pantomime, isn't it? Boo. This one, six sacrifices in singleness that will benefit you later in marriage. Again, it's just kind of like, oh, the point in... Yeah, thank you. Really getting into this now. This is good. And this is my favourite. This is six practical tips for coping with long-term singleness. What? I love the fact that it's black. It's got a really miserable woman. And there's this language. It's like how to cope with it. Like it's, you know, some awful disease. It's not about flourishing or thriving or blessing others, but coping. Single people are often seen as a bit of a problem, aren't they, rather than a gift to the church. We often say that marriage and singleness are both gifts, and we're aware that that's biblical, but we don't always act like it. We sometimes act like singleness is the gift that nobody wants. My mum, because I'm sort of vaguely musical, my mum went through a phase of buying me novelty ocarinas. If you don't know what an ocarina is, it's basically a recorder shaped like a ladybird. The worst possible instrument. But this isn't the worst present that I've ever come across. So Abby, 1 year for Christmas, was presented with this monstrosity. Which is... It's basically like a ceramic cat money box handbag. I mean, who wouldn't want one of those? She's still got it, so yeah. And why didn't you bring it this weekend? Just enjoy that for a bit. We don't need to do the rest of this. The bottom line is that when sex is seen as vital to human flourishing, both inside and outside the church, to deny it to anyone is seen as impossible, and the push to change the church's teaching on same-sex marriage becomes stronger. So if we believe the cultural story that people are missing out if they're denied a sexual relationship, then we're forced to say that objecting to gay marriage is cruel. So this diagram kind of shows the logic of an escape from singleness and virginity for all. If virginity and singleness are seen as a problem or a horrible affliction, then it's only fair that gay people can have the same chances to escape as straight people. But contrasted to that, sexual holiness is profoundly countercultural. This is the backdrop to our discipleship, and it's undoubtedly tough to live out a biblical sexual ethic in a culture that's so opposed to it. Which brings me to my second point. Being a light in the darkness is hard. An inevitable part of our calling to live as citizens of heaven and therefore exiles in this world is that we will suffer as our kingdom values clash with worldly values. But suffering isn't permanent for Christians, as we confidently anticipate a time when the earth will be fully transformed to pattern God's purposes. In the meantime, we should expect to suffer in a world that rejects God and rejects his rule. But it's not just a case of putting a brave face on and hoping that Jesus comes back tomorrow. Living lives of obedience here and now isn't just an investment in future reward, but the way that Christians bear witness to a holy God in whose image we're made. Suffering isn't a result of a mistake in God's design for sexuality, which we've seen is really good. We need to regain confidence that holiness is a gift from God for our flourishing rather than a legalistic restriction for our diminishing. Living God's way now brings blessings now, even as it's misunderstood and criticised by wider society. Indeed, you know, reading through the Bible, we know that suffering and deep joy often go hand in hand, don't they? The cost of discipleship for all Christians should be high. Jesus tells us to take up our cross and to follow him. But lots of us have failed to live in a costly countercultural way, especially sexually. Over the years, the church has shifted the goalposts on birth control and divorce and advanced reproductive technologies, cohabitation, sex outside marriage, to the extent that we've arrived at a position where it seems that we're asking gay people to surrender too much. But maybe for a long time, the church hasn't been giving up enough. Costly discipleship isn't optional for Christians. When we sign up to follow him, Jesus promises that it'll be tough. Sadly, sometimes we make the gospel all about getting to heaven rather than living a Christ-transformed countercultural life that reflects God's holy character to the world. There's lots of ways that Christians have adopted the norms and values of our culture, aren't there? It's easy for us to be embroiled in consumerism and individualism, materialism, other stuff that ends in ism. For too many Christians in our culture, there isn't a lot of difference between our lives and those of colleagues and friends. I think this is where same-sex attracted Christians, we've actually got a really important missional role to play, and we can call the church to deeper discipleship. For us, the cost of following Jesus is obvious. It's harder to fit in with the culture and adopt its values without obviously revising scriptural teaching. This gives us the opportunity to lead the way in challenging the wider church to deeper discipleship and dependence on God. We can model to others what it looks like to follow Jesus with a costly obedience in all areas of life. It's not about us being spiritual superstars. We've talked a bit about how we all mess up and we all need God's grace every single second of every day. But it's about handing our whole lives over to Jesus to be transformed by him. And we're in good company. There are Christians around the world who are giving everything to follow Jesus. The cost of discipleship is everything for all of us, isn't it? And that is inclusive. That's an inclusive gospel. Central to being lights in the darkness is an uncompromising commitment to model our lives on God's commands, regardless of cultural norms and values, so that we can reach our culture with Christ's love. This is undoubtedly hard, but it is worth it. Which brings us to our third point. It's easy and tempting to think that we need to revise our teaching on sexuality so that we don't put people off the church by the traditional teaching that's seen as outdated or offensive. But, I mean, the gospel is offensive, isn't it? It's always been offensive to the surrounding culture because it exposes our sinful condition. I really like this bit of John's gospel where it says, "This is the verdict. Light has come into the world, but people love darkness instead of light because their deeds were evil." In our previous sessions, we talked about God's goodness in the boundaries he sets for sexual expression. But sometimes it's hard to hold on to that when we're bombarded by images of happy gay couples selling chips and stuff. It's really cynical, isn't it, how brands tap into the cultural zeitgeist to just flog stuff, basically. Or maybe we're encouraged to wear a pride badge at work because love is love. But what if these projected images don't tell the whole story? What if the cultural narrative is more bankrupt than we'd like to admit? And what if biblical sexuality is better than the alternative? And that it's the way that human beings are meant to flourish? Returning to Glyn Harrison's book, he challenges us to be better at critiquing the culture. And the reality is that the sexual revolution of the 60s and 70s, which kind of promised more and better sex for everybody, hasn't actually delivered. Here are some statistics. Apparently, we're having sex at any age, on average, 2 or 3 times a week, when in previous decades it was 5. And Public Health England apparently found out that half of women aged 25 to 34 don't enjoy sex. That's quite a significant proportion, isn't it? As orthodox Christian sexual morality has largely been rejected, family breakdown has increased, and there's an epidemic of relational poverty and loneliness. An analysis of data from 2009 to 2010 shows that 45% of teenagers studying for GCSEs aren't living with both parents. That's tragic. And the UK has among the highest rates of family breakdown in Europe. Finally, more than 8 million people were living alone in 2018, and that figure is increasing year on year. So it seems like the reality for a lot of people doesn't match the marketing and the Hollywood glitz. It can also be tempting to see the LGBT community as one big, happy, rainbow family. And a lot of people have, you know, found comfort in that community, and there are good things about it. But there are also competing and incompatible ideologies at the heart of it. The LGB Alliance was specifically set up to challenge trans ideology. Here's something that they say on their website. "We believe that biological sex is observed at birth and not assigned. In our view, current gender ideologies are pseudoscientific and present a threat to people whose sexual orientation is towards the same sex or both sexes. In addition, we believe that these ideologies are confusing and dangerous to children." And lesbian tennis star Martina Navratilova was criticised by the trans community for some of her remarks about women, trans women in sport. As Christians, we need to understand our culture better, and we need to recognise that we need to offer a robust critique as well as gospel hope. In this cultural climate, we can regain our confidence that biblical teaching on sexuality is really good news for LGBT people. So, could it be that the biblical sexual ethic that's often criticised for being outdated and even harmful is actually the answer to loneliness, pain and broken relationships around us? Could it be that it's not about what you're not allowed to do, but it's about enjoying the very best relationships possible with God and with each other? We've seen how biblical sexuality tracks the gospel story of God's relationship with his people, his covenant faithfulness to those he loves. The clear purpose of Israel's priestly role as a holy nation and the church's mandate for holiness is to glorify God and make him known. So God's pattern for sexuality is good news, and it's integral to the gospel itself. So how are biblical sexual ethics light in the darkness of our culture, and why are they worth living by? Well, firstly, and we looked at this a little bit in the first session, God sets the standards. God knows what's best for us, and he's revealed that to us in his word. To nick a phrase from the video, The Beautiful Story, we're inheritors, not inventors, of a pattern of right sexual relating. And if you haven't seen this film, I recommend it. It's about half an hour. It's by the, who's it by? Church of England Evangelical Council. And it's a really, it's a beautiful video about a beautiful story. There's lots of people sharing about the goodness of biblical sexuality. So it's on YouTube, so look that up later. Sexual morality is rooted in creational design for the purpose of blessing the nations and glorifying God. So we're not free to redefine sexual morality according to our own understanding. We have to allow the one who created sexuality to determine how we use it. In Exodus 19:3-6, we saw that God saves his people for them to enjoy blessing and to share it. Salvation brings with it a call to holiness and transformation, and the nature of this changed life is crucial for Christian discipleship and mission. The call to live by God's standards is part of the good news of the gospel, and we actually dishonour God and LGBT people when we jeopardise their salvation and discipleship by rejecting biblical teaching on sexuality. A revisionist message, or an affirming message, one that says same-sex sexual relationships are fine, actually causes harm because it affirms people in sin and it traps people in behaviours that separate them from God. So it's not good news. Without a universal call to repentance from whatever sinful behaviours are enslaving people, the gospel isn't the gospel at all. Secondly, God's standards are good. We saw in the first session that God's standards aren't arbitrary. So we can't pick and choose what we're going to obey. Indeed, the desire to decide for ourselves what's good and evil was kind of at the heart of the fall, wasn't it? God's people must remember that God is good and desires to give his followers good things. I really love this in Matthew's Gospel. If you then, though you are evil, know how to give good gifts to your children, how much more will your Father in heaven give good gifts to those who ask him? He's a good Father. We can trust him. He loves us. He wants to give us good things. At the centre of the whole debate around same-sex marriage is the question of whether what God prescribes is good or harmful. The goodness of marriage and its importance for community and stability and the raising of children is often acknowledged, but the call to widen its definition to same-sex couples rests on this damaging assumption about singleness and celibacy. So we looked earlier at the negative cultural perceptions of virginity and celibacy in the society that worships sex and makes it integral to flourishing. And we saw that mirrored to a certain extent in the church idolising marriage. I think sometimes marriage is seen as difficult but worth it, and singleness is seen as a sort of deprivation to be endured for the Lord, which can lead to a situation where it seems unfair to deny a relationship to same-sex attracted people. But giving up desires for the sake of Christ has always been the way of true discipleship. Celibacy and sexual holiness aren't easy, but they're neither forgiveness or enemy love. We're called and equipped to do the impossible by the living God who helps us to reveal his heart to the world. We've seen that we can flourish and we can enjoy life to the full, but we absolutely can't live life as it's meant to be without intimacy with God. God's standards are different. We're probably getting that impression by now. We might be persuaded into thinking that revising the Bible's teaching on same-sex relationships is enlightened and progressive, but actually it isn't radical enough because it just reinforces the harmful ideologies that underpin cultural sexuality rather than challenging them. There's a lot of stuff around at the moment about conversion therapy. I'm sure you've seen stuff in the news and, lots of debates happening at the minute. And it rightly criticises the ex-gay movement for promoting this ideal of a heterosexual partnership for same-sex attracted people. The real problem was that it made healing about heterosexuality rather than about holiness. But the affirming movement does exactly the same thing. The notion that it takes this sort of ungodly idolatry of a romantic relationship and elevates that. So the notion that a romantic partner that can fulfil all your longings is as hopelessly damaging for LGBT people as it is for heterosexual people. The undervaluing of singleness and non-sexual friendship is at the heart of support for gay marriage, and it's really damaging. It just mirrors our culture's idolatry of sex. And that's not good news to a society that's fractured by family breakdown and experiencing the ill effects of the sexual revolution. Only the traditional biblical sexual ethic radically challenges the assumption that sexual relationships are the only or the main place to experience intimacy. Biblical marriage and singleness both uniquely point beyond themselves to God, who so loved the world that he gave his only son. Marriage reflects the faithful, committed and exclusive relationship between Christ and his bride, the church. And similarly, singleness points to our new creation reality and showcases the faithfulness and sufficiency of Christ. This is wonderful news, especially considering the bankruptcy of the alternative. We aren't calling people from lives of sexual freedom and contentment to lives of repression and misery, but we're calling people out of darkness into light. Listen to 1 Peter 2:9. But you are a chosen people, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, God's special possession, that you may declare the praises of him who called you out of darkness into his wonderful light. A worldly idolatry of sex hasn't led to an increase in human happiness and fulfilment. In fact, we see more divorce and family breakdown. There's plenty of sexual violence around. The Me Too movement highlighted that. Porn use is increasing. But in wonderful and radical contrast, A countercultural biblical sexuality affirms and includes everybody and challenges us all to submit our sexualities to God's will in lives of communal, holy obedience, characterised by deep love for God and deep love for each other. And finally, and really briefly, God's standards are possible. We might at this point be thinking, well, the theory sounds really good, but I just struggle too much. I can't live up to God's standards. Maybe God's being unfair in not letting same-sex attracted people act on our attractions because it's so hard. The thing is, it is hard. In fact, it's impossible for any of us to live out God's commands without his help. I often read that bit in Matthew 5, be perfect, therefore, as your heavenly Father is perfect, and think, well, that's hard, isn't it? But we can't do it without him. The good news is that what's impossible with man is possible with God. In the first session, we looked at Ezekiel 36, which showed us that it's only God's initiative and transforming work in our hearts that enables us to live out his commands. And that's all I'm going to say on that in this session, because tomorrow we're going to look at Jesus and how only his love can set us free to walk in the light. So for those of you who like a summary, this is what we've just said. Being a light in the darkness is countercultural. Being a light in the darkness is hard, but being a light in the darkness is worth it because God sets the standards. God's standards are good. God's standards are different and God's standards are possible. That's it for now. Enjoy the rest of your day.